And our first guest wants to talk about artificial intelligence, which gets a reasonable amount of coverage in the popular press these days. Sometimes utopian, as in driverless vehicles. Sometimes dystopian, as in robots taking over the world. Sometimes it's both. Robots giving us more free time, but also putting us out of a job. Now, my first guest tonight wants to talk about artificial intelligence in the medical sector and why we need to prepare for it. His name is Chris Boniface. He's a Canterbury University PhD student. He's on the line now. Kia ora, Chris.
Kia ora, Brian. How's it going?
It's going fine. Where are we at the moment in terms of artificial intelligence and medicine?
In terms of New Zealand, it's not really a thing that's happening here. But in terms of Europe or Asia, for example, it's something that's begun. It's entering semi-regular use, but in ways that people don't necessarily expect. It's not robots walking around corridors at the moment, but decisions being made by doctors are being made by computers, and then doctors are relaying them to people, for example. That's the sort of classic example at the moment.
So how might that work in practice?
In practice, the most simple example is you go to a doctor with a problem, doctor performs a series of tests, but the doctor doesn't analyze the results of those tests. They're plugged into a system. System says, this is probably what's wrong with the person, this is probably what you should do, and that advice is what the doctor relies on.
In other words, at the moment, the machine is providing information and advice rather than making a decision.
Yes, that's quite common in a lot of places at the moment. However, there's a shift at the moment happening with more advanced systems, mostly in a sort of trial capacity, of course, where the entire process is done by a machine. You go in, it chooses what you need to do, it does it, it tells you what to do, and it may even prescribe things to you, and you leave. And it's possible to do this without ever seeing a person.
How close are we to having a machine deal with a patient? Say, now, there are many different aspects to health. You've got emergency health, you've got just going to see your GP. Let's start with the GP at the moment. How soon before maybe we rely on some of those routine consultations that we have with GPs being done by machine?
Something routine and mundane could be done right now. And in fact, there are services in Europe, for example, that currently do that. However, in terms of sort of public willingness to do this, I would say it's maybe a little bit further off. Something about a sort of a non-person making decisions about private things like that kind of unsettles people a little bit. So the sort of willingness to take that step might be a few years off, but it's completely possible.
But the interesting thing, Chris, is that maybe, because I think a lot of us, when we think of artificial intelligence, we think of a single point of intelligence. Yeah. In other words, a robot, a machine, bit like us, really, only it's a machine, and we deal with that. Possibly, it's going to be more likely that we're dealing with a system that makes decisions. Say I'm at home, and I'm just imagining this, and I want to get a prescription on, I don't know, my antidepressants or something like that. And there might be a survey I can fill out, and the system assesses, the software assesses whether I need to keep getting my prescription or not. That could save a doctor a lot of time, couldn't it? It could save me a lot of time.
Oh, absolutely. And there are actually apps on the open market available that do exactly that in certain places. There are diagnostic apps that you can have on your phone that will make medical judgments. Certain countries don't allow them right now for sort of safety reasons, but the service is available, and it's more about whether or not countries want to allow them or people trust them is the sort of critical point.
Now, moving to more serious situations, say surgery, and a really difficult operation where, once again, maybe a machine can deal with some of the stuff that a human can't do so well. Now, how advanced are we in that area? That seemed to be something you were talking about at the start of the interview.
Yes. In terms of fully automated, so a person not controlling it, that has been tested as of last year in Japan. Probably a little bit further off. It's not quite there where it's precise without any sort of human input. However, sort of systems in which a surgeon makes minor decisions and the AI does the sort of more precise calculations, has been happening for at least 6-7 years now.
Now, you talked about something called the Da Vinci robot.
The Da Vinci robot, yes.
Right. Now, and that involves what? It's not entirely a robot, is it? It's not autonomous, is it?
No, it's a sort of giant six-armed controller, in a way. There's a surgeon involved, but the surgeon doesn't have to be in the room. It's sort of like he could be in another hospital and have a surgery down the street, and he can control it digitally.
We have seen this in popular culture recently. I'm pretty sure that there's an ad for 5G, which involves a surgeon remotely operating. It's not a human, it's a dog. But, you know, it's aiming at putting on the old heartstrings and saying, look what 5G can do. You mean the remote doctor saved the dog thanks to 5G. But that's kind of what, along the lines of what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, that's what the Da Vinci can do right now, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I've spoken to a New Zealand-born American engineer who's involved with something very much like the Da Vinci machine, and this was remote control of surgery and getting him with a keyhole and then very, very small apparatus inside the body doing stuff which allows you to do a lot of tricky stuff inside a body without opening up a big hole to get at it.
Yeah, absolutely. The classic Da Vinci advertisement they use in the States is they can perform surgery on a grape. That's how precise it is. They can take the skin off a grape and they can do all sorts of things with this huge machine because of how accurate it is, which a person would really, really struggle to do by comparison.
Now, where has this become problematic? Has it become problematic?
The Da Vinci itself isn't really the problem, although a person did actually die in a surgery that was blamed on the Da Vinci service, but the Da Vinci robot isn't fully autonomous. The problem comes when you move that one little step further, which is not a big step. It's completely feasible that it could be done now, when you remove a human involved, because then the problem becomes, who is at fault? You know, you can't, sort of at the extreme, you can't sue a doctor if there was no doctor involved, but you can't sue a robot because the robot can't pay you, the robot can't lose its job, it doesn't care, it doesn't know any better. You enter this weird situation where something's gone wrong and you're upset or you're hurt or you're out of a lot of money or whatever it is and you have no idea what to do. And there's no one really knows what to do because these problems have only just started being discussed and they've really only just become relevant, basically.
That case in Newcastle, Britain, this is 5 years ago now, a patient died following heart surgery, which was at the time seemed low risk. A coroner later found that it was due in part because the operation happened with the assistance of a Da Vinci robot, quotation marks around Da Vinci robot. So what did the robot do? I mean, if a robot is still controlled, if it's actually more a remote control surgical machine that's still run by a human, is it actually fair to call it a robot?
Actually, yes, it's definitely fair to call it a robot. It's definitely not fair to suggest it's autonomous, which some of the articles around this incident have gone that little step further. It's definitely a robot, but in that situation, the sort of general consensus is that if the surgeon did it by hand, they wouldn't have relied on the Da Vinci service as much, and that would have led to slightly different decisions being made, sort of things being done in a different way. I'm not a heart surgeon, unfortunately, so I can't speak to the sort of technical aspects of that, but the suggestion seems to be that they relied on this miraculous service that actually wasn't necessary in that case.
Is it possible, because one of the big advantages in this kind of surgical tool is, as I said earlier, it's you're able to get into the body and do surgery, which means you don't have to open up such a big hole, because the bigger the hole is, the more likely you are to deal with blood loss and infection when you open up more of a wound, the longer the recovery period is. So there are many reasons to try and make that hole as small as possible. Problem is that if you don't open it up, you can't see so well as a human how much trouble is going on underneath, right?
Yeah, definitely fair. And I think that's a big part with a lot of, not just in surgery, but a lot of these sort of emergent technologies, is that they offer all sorts of benefits, but the sort of counter benefits and the things that we've come accustomed to or that people have been trained to do sort of fall a little bit by the wayside. I think people get a little starry-eyed at the benefits and sort of forget everything else that's going on around it necessarily.
But that sounds more like us just not getting smart enough with the technology, as you say, getting a bit carried away, as opposed to handing over some of the responsibility, some of the decision-making to a machine. Because you can't really expect the machine to know that actually we've got a sicker heart than we thought if you don't open up so you can see the heart. I'm thinking that for you, the bigger problem is when the machine starts saying, you need treatment X, when a human might have said treatment Y and the machine gets it wrong.
Yes, definitely. Especially like the example you've just given, misdiagnosis. There's a lot of discussion starting to happen about sort of if you overrule the AI, are you then liable, or are you in the position to overrule an AI if you're relying on it for this technology? If it's supposed to give better results, should human beings have the power to overrule it? Or if it does misdiagnose, do you blame the doctor who chose to use the system? Or is it a fault of the design of the system? Is it a fault of the hospital for bringing in the system? There's a whole sort of layer of where you actually sort of target complaint, I think. Way of putting it.
In countries where the technology is getting to this point, what does the law say?
Unfortunately, it doesn't. A lot of the United States has done a lot of sort of early preliminary testing on this, and the FDA is doing a lot of inquiries as to whether they should allow it and when it should be tested and things. And the problem is they're sort of, at least from my understanding and looking at it, they're trying to make situations fit into the law that already exists, mostly because situations haven't happened yet. They're sort of, nothing bad's happened yet. If it did, we would make it, would stick it into normal consent or negligent law or whatever. But I don't think they're thinking about the way these technologies are different. And once you actually get to that step, it becomes obvious that those laws don't work anymore. Some of the requirements just don't fit. They have to be tweaked, they have to be changed a little bit, but you can't just, it's a sort of trying to stick a square peg in a circle hole. There's something missing.
Well, Chris, how do you think we should approach it then? Do you,
I think...
No, carry on. I've had another question come into my head, but I want you to answer that one first.
I think the law needs to make it a judgment about what it considers important. Now, this is kind of a big focus of my research, and that I don't know what the answer to that is, but there's going to be issues of whether people's sort of respect or their privacy or their consent in the system is considered more important than the results of the system, because these technologies do offer amazing benefits and sort of right into the realm of science fiction, but there's going to be problems. There's going to be a lot of teething problems at the start. Some people, unfortunately, are going to end up being the sort of legal guinea pigs where they have to go through the court to get these answers. And I think the question is it worth it?
What are those benefits to your mind, Chris?
The sort of big one is just efficiency. The hospitals, I think anyone who's ever gone into a hospital will tell you, will know it's slow. It's an arduous process. You go in, you might sit in a waiting room for 40 minutes. A lot of that triage, a lot of that early stuff can be done by AI systems. You can massively streamline the process, and then people with more serious things that require more serious and sort of more intense attention from the system can get that. You can reduce the pressure on the system as a whole. And at the other end, of course, AI offers the ability to diagnose things that might go undetected to the normal sort of medical practitioner.
Now, Chris, let's look at the accident and emergency situation.
Yep.
How might AI work? I arrive at the hospital with a query over something. Maybe I've got chest pain. Mm-hmm. And so what would I deal with, a human first? I assume I'm still being driven by an ambulance that's got humans driving it, okay? So they will check me out first, right?
If you get out of the ambulance and the sort of conception of the system that's evolving at the moment, the people who brought you there would plug in what they know. They would say chest pain, male of this age, and your medical records would be in this system. It would take the information that's been given, the information it already knows about you, and it would make a determination. And in the exact same way that triage works now, where you're given a sort of score of how urgent it is, it would do that, and it would pass it on to everyone else in the system so that they're aware this person is there and he's going to go through these steps. And it would create a plan, exactly what steps you're supposed to take, how long you can wait, when you can fit in. It can do the scheduling for you. It can notify people for you. It can essentially do the process of triage in 10 seconds, maybe even less, depending on how much money the hospital is willing to spend on a system like this. And it can just save huge amounts of time. And also that triage nurse who would otherwise be seeing you could be involved in a different thing. She could be helping someone else. She could be helping someone who's in a more serious condition. Someone could come in, bleeding, gunshot wound, whatever. And she can help address that.
Okay,
someone
Chris.
Maybe
so,
not.
Yep. So I'm imagining I'm dropped off. The ambulance people plug my details into a machine. Somebody will take me to a bed, I assume, and show me to a bed to lie down.
Yes, hopefully.
Yep, and yes. So that, but then after that, there may not be any further human connection, and so the artificial intelligence has notified a doctor or a senior nurse to come and look at me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, and actually the human connection that you mentioned there is sort of what I'm focusing on right now in my research about how people sort of respond to these technologies. Because when it's described like this, it does sound a little sort of cold and heartless.
That's exactly what I was thinking about almost the placebo effect of having people one trusts looking after
exactly.
me, making me think, people have got me here. I can relax a bit. And will a machine do that? I mean, if we end up trusting the machines, then that could happen.
Exactly, yeah. And there's a lot of very interesting research coming out about what people prefer. Like, does the AI, does it have a physical body? Is it a robot? Does it have a face? Does it have a name? And sort of the ways to help people cross that bridge, because whether people trust the system is really the ultimate requirement for whether or not the system works. If people don't trust it, they're not going to go to the hospital, and then the whole system is pointless.
Which brings us back almost in going in a circular direction back to the next thing I wanted to ask you about. So we set up AI to do this. Mm-hmm. How do we make sure AI doesn't fail? How do you introduce, because AI it almost has to learn stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah. Fortunately, some countries and hospitals around the world have already started taking this step for us. Google, for example, has a system that's currently being used by the NHS for testing in the United Kingdom. And the idea is that once it's tested on a small enough scale, it can be expanded to a slightly bigger scale, and then a slightly bigger scale. And the idea is that you sort of stagger the introduction of it across an entire system. You don't just sort of one day walk in and the whole hospital's AI, because then that would be a disaster, frankly. But New Zealand is in a quite nice position in that we can see all these things happening. We can see these countries developing, and there are problems occurring in some of them. But the idea being that we can slowly introduce it at our own speed, and we have the advantage of being able to possibly think of solutions to these problems before they come here.
Now, going back to the very start of this, Chris, you said New Zealand needs to get ready for this. What do we need to get ready? How do we get ready for this? What do you want us to start doing now?
I think the best thing would be some sort of law commission inquiry. Someone other than me needs to look into this kind of thing, because there has been quite a lot of research out of Otago on AI in general, but it's focused on things like finance and things like the military and sort of different uses of AI. Medicine seems to be something that's a little bit overlooked. There's been a couple mentions of it by a group called AI Forum up in Auckland, but medicine seems to be the one that isn't on everybody's mind for whatever reason that is, but in my opinion, it's the one that has the most potential to impact people at their most vulnerable, people who are sick, dying, dealing with loss, and it's something that needs to be looked at. I think there's a lot of legal issues there, and it's not really about finding solutions as much as it is identifying the problems before they happen, so that when they happen, at least there's some sort of thought happening. The wheel is turned a little bit so that whoever this happens to first isn't stuck in a 5-year legal situation where they have to wait for an answer, essentially.
Do we need to have AI trials like we have drug trials?
I would suggest yes, but that would depend on the kind of system. Unfortunately, AI is this sort of immense umbrella term that one system is not the same as another. How they're introduced, I think, is very much going to depend on some sort of judgment by the Ministry of Health, frankly. Little ones can come in probably without any sort of trial, as normal software would, but some of the more complicated ones would definitely need to be trialed and regulated more thoroughly, especially the sort of Da Vinci robot situation.
Do we have, at the moment in New Zealand, the ability for us to use AI to get prescriptions?
No, not in New Zealand.
No, I didn't think so.
No, it's something that's being trialed at the moment in parts of Europe, but it's not sort of freely available. That's in the sort of going through the testing situation at the moment.
The other thing, and this may seem slightly superficial, but there is part of me that feels there's a slight sinking feeling when I think that maybe Google will end up being the thing that runs, the organisation that runs A&E departments around the world. It's almost a little bit of national sovereignty kind of thing, and that's an awful lot of something that I really value going offshore in terms of who controls it.
That's one of the sort of fundamental problems that AI has, is that these systems, as you said, they need to learn. And to learn, they need massive amounts of data. And unfortunately, there are very few companies or institutions in the world capable of supplying that. Things like Google, Amazon, Oracle, Facebook, they have this data. How we accept their use and how we share our data and what happens to our data afterwards is some of these issues, especially in sort of medical privacy, that need to be discussed, because it's almost certain that if your doctor is using a system for, say, radiology diagnosis, that your data is being sent somewhere in California, processed, and then sent back. And how we deal with that and whether we allow that and what sort of restrictions we put on that and whether restrictions would even work, frankly, because, you know, they're in America. They don't particularly care what we're necessarily telling them to do. That's something that we're going to have to think about, unfortunately.
I said at the beginning you're a PhD student. Is this what your PhD thesis is in?
Yes, it is, yep.
So how far are you from writing it all up?
I'll be finished in the next 6 months, maybe.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're going to have some conclusions by then?
Oh, I'm hoping to. They're sort of starting to form, but because everything's sort of, it's so fresh and things are still happening, every time I write something, something else happens, and then I feel like I have to change my mind. So it's a little bit of a shifting goalpost, unfortunately.
Chris, thank you very much for joining us, and all the best for the rest of your thesis.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure, Chris. That's PhD student from Canterbury University, Chris Boniface, talking about AI and medicine and how we need to prepare for that, both its problems and its benefits, in his opinion.